Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, before we get the show started, I wanted to let you know we are giving away a bunch of brand new Black Magic gear.
Yeah, cameras, switchers, DaVinci Resolve licenses, a bunch of awesome stuff. So stay tuned to learn how you can enter to win free gear from Black Magic, and we're going to tell you all about it later on in this episode. Now cue the music. Hey, welcome to the 151st episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode was brought to you by patrons Dempsey Tapley, Evelyn Belasco, Shane Collins, and Stephen Heliker. I'm Oren Kaplan.
And I'm Matt Edlow.
Today we've got Jocelyn DeBoer and Don Luby. They just got back from Sundance with their feature film Greener Grass, in which they star, directed, and wrote. So they're a triple threat. We're going to talk about how they turned their successful short into a feature film. That's kind of a long road that's really fascinating, but then also they managed to make the feature in record speed. They're an incredible collaborative team. It's a real treat.
Yeah, I mean, it is insane. We find out in this interview that they started writing in January of last year and they played at Sundance in January of 2019.
Just like, incredible.
Yeah. How fast do you have to make a movie to get into Sundance after Sundance?
Yeah, you'll learn from them. It's a really great episode, especially if you want to make your own feature or if you have a short and you want to figure out how to make it into a feature.
Yeah.
These two have all of the answers. They did it, so can you. It's a great conversation. I can't wait to hop into it. I think we're going to bypass our catch-up today. But before we get into our conversation with Jocelyn and Don, we have one important thing to talk about, and that is our Patreon.
Yes, that is our Patreon. You guys should check it out.
Patreon.com/justshootitpod. It's the rolling Kickstarter crowdfunding sort of situation where you subscribe a little bit of money to us every single month to keep the show going. It's like buying us a cup of coffee or paying a buck or two for an episode. And it helps us do things like throw live events, pay for all sorts of bandwidth and sponsorship, do remote recordings, which is a new thing that we've been doing more of. All the little things that have kind of changed and grown out of the show in the last year or two. I think that we're really trying to evolve the program, and that's thanks to your patronage.
Yeah, it's awesome. We've been getting a lot of patrons lately. Two of our five biggest patrons have actually been former guests on our show.
That's incredible.
Yeah, I guess that's a one way to self-promote. But yeah, we really appreciate it. Check it out. It helps us a lot, and it's awesome. So thanks. And without any further ado, let's get into it with Don and Jocelyn. Well, hey, Jocelyn and Don, thanks for coming over.
Hi, we're happy to be here. This is Jocelyn's voice.
This is Don's voice.
This is Matt's voice.
This is also Matt's voice.
Oh, weird. You guys are just back from Sundance. When did you get back?
We are late Sunday night. So
okay.
Yeah. Like long. A couple nights ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were you there the entire time?
We were. Mm-hmm. Our movie, we weren't going to. And then our movie screened Thursday, Friday, and Saturday of the second weekend. And we were like, we've got to go.
Yeah. Yeah. You got to go.
Right?
Yeah.
You did the first weekend too.
We did.
Yeah.
The whole shebang.
And were there like events or like photo sessions or things like for the filmmakers that first weekend?
Yes. The first weekend was very busy. We had, I guess, what you'd call two press days where we went around and did press.
And on those press days, is that something Sundance arranged for you or like your publicist?
Our publicist. And then Sundance also arranges so many nice dinners for the filmmakers, and they have this cinema cafe thing where you get to I think be on the Sundance Channel.
Wear your lanyard.
Yeah, we wore our lanyards everywhere.
That sounds pretty cool. I guess I should apply to Sundance. I always just thought it was kind of like a throwaway festival.
You get a lot of free swag, and I mean that was the main reason we wanted.
Sure,
to go.
Yeah, right, yeah, right, yeah, definitely.
That's the only reason you made your movie.
Yeah, for the swag.
Your vision board is like just all swag.
I used to make the joke about how all film festivals were filled with Stella Artois and pop chips.
Yeah, yes. Wait, that is actually
it's still the
still
case.
A relevant
oh man,
joke.
Yeah, great.
Okay, so. So how'd you guys get in? What's the story? What's your movie, I guess? Let's start with that.
Our movie is a feature called Greener Grass, which Don and I wrote, executive produced, starred in, and directed.
That's a lot of guys.
We don't trust other people.
It's just like to work with each other.
And it was based off of a short, correct?
It was. It was based off of a short film we wrote, starred in, executive produced, and our great friend Paul Briganti directed, which was the first project Don and I made together back in the summer of 2015. It was on the festival circuit in 2016.
And did pretty darn well, right? Like South by... Yeah. Other fancy places I'm forgetting.
I do want to mention one fancy place, which was our premiere for Greener Grass called Clermont-Ferrand.
Oh, yeah. That's
Have
a fancy
you guys
one.
Heard of it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. It's shorts only, right? Is that right
shorts
or no?
Shorts only. Yes. It is the Cannes of short film festivals. And I feel like so few people know about it in the States, but I feel like it was career changing to us to go there.
We had never heard of it. We made our short and we Googled best film,
like
festivals,
film festivals
for short films.
Yeah, it was
and
the
this showed
top
up.
10. Yes.
Yeah, so we're like, okay, we'll apply here. I think it was free to apply or like €3. And had no idea what it was.
That's kind of its vibe though, right? Like it's kind of meant to be democratic like that, right?
Yeah, but they pay for you to... I think you pay for your flight, but they pay for your hotel.
Yeah,
and we were there over a week.
Yeah, and they give you...
Per diem.
Per diem. So it's... aside from getting there,
they
it's
give you per
totally
diem?
Free.
Yeah.
I've never heard of a festival doing that.
No.
For shorts.
And for shorts, you also don't get your hotel paid. The only other festival that put us up was New Orleans, which is also a great festival. But yeah, so Clermont-Ferrand is where we premiered. And we were
where is it?
It's in a town called Clermont-Ferrand, France.
Yeah, kind of in... I want to say the center of France, like a couple hours south of Paris.
Mm-hmm. Wait, but didn't you make a short before that, The Arrival?
The Arrival we made in 2017.
Yeah.
Oh, about... after Greener Grass.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so you made Greener Grass and got into a bunch of festivals, including South By and Clermont.
Yes, and before we even got accepted to Clermont-Ferrand, we were already on set for our second short, which is called Buzz, which might be our favorite thing that we've made.
Is Buzz available to watch or
it
no?
is not. It just recently kind of completed its festival run, and we're going to release it on Vimeo soon. So Buzz, we were on the set of Buzz. We were shooting on location and
near the Neverland Ranch.
Yeah, right near the Neverland
Ranch. Very close to that in like the central coast of California.
And we found out we got into Clermont-Ferrand on set for that. Yeah. We were like, what is this?
That's a good vibe, right?
Yeah, but I guess
you probably don't realize how awesome it is yet, right?
No.
Yeah, yeah.
But we were thinking about that recently because in my head it's always like, oh, Greener Grass was successful as a short. Then we decided to make a second one. But that wasn't it at all. We hadn't gotten into anything and we were already full tilt boogie on the
But you kind of knew. So I've seen Greener Grass. And I think I saw The Arrival. The Arrival, it's also baby-related, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
They're both baby-related.
Uh-huh. Buzz has no babies.
Oh, okay. I won't watch it then. I only watch baby stuff.
Hard pass from Oren.
I feel like you could tell it the short is good without getting into it before you hear back from any festivals.
It's well, like, but to be fair, it's also really risky. Like, it's a weird movie. And so I'm sure any filmmaker would be like... Are we sure about this one?
Yeah.
You know, like there's that thing of like, oh, I love it. Will other people get it? Is a question I'm sure you must have had, right?
We did have that, to the point of it wasn't clear on set that people thought it was funny. You know how sometimes making things and like the grips are laughing and the other actors are laughing. I think like Nick and Brian, like close friends of ours who played our husbands, would attest that they weren't like, this is going to be great. Right.
Oh, they didn't think it was
festivals. They were really, like, really?
Awesome.
It
did. That's awesome.
Well, it is funny in the way.
I really want listeners to be aware of that. Though, like, that is an incredible, like, you have like a very successful feature film based off of a short
that
people weren't sure they liked, and they were starring it.
I think that's true.
Our good friends.
Our families did not like Green Acres. My family is a little weirder than Don. My parents loved it, but my younger sister did not get it. Like, we absolutely lost her when Jill gives the baby away.
I guess it's probably worth describing what it's about, because it's like tonally very extreme, right?
Yes, that's true. So it's a dark comedy. That has a psychological thriller aspect that's satirizing suburbia. Mm-hmm.
Right. I guess like a Stepford Wives kind of vibe.
Sure. Yeah, but totally. Like,
but crazier. Like David Lynch-y as well, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. What were the references that you were kind of tossing around together to like hone in on the tone?
We were lucky in that we had the short as a reference when we were doing the feature for the tone. And then in addition to that, we wanted to be very careful about using any film or TV references, because we so badly wanted the world to seem like this unique world you've just never seen before. Mm-hmm. And so what we did is use photography as a reference.
Oh, cool.
So particularly the work of Gregory Crudson. I don't know if you guys are familiar, but the like domestic, you kind of disturbing surreal scenes with very controlled lighting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also,
and that was your reference for the short.
We use that just for the feature. Yeah. For the short, I don't know with Paul what we were referencing back then. Yeah. It was
like one of the weird things is that you guys have, you're adults and you have braces.
Yes. Every adult has braces.
I don't think our short is like this that much, but at the time we were like very delighted by the web series Catherine,
which Dean Fleischerkamp made with Jenny Slate.
Yeah. And I think we liked the humor in that, although I'm not sure it really is much of a comparison to the short.
What I remember loving about Catherine was the simplicity of it and the nostalgia. It's kind of timeless and it just feels like my childhood, like things that were on TV. And then Catherine has this cool aspect of I read that Dean and Jenny were trying to achieve neutrality in emotions. So like no one gets like too worked up about anything. It's always this, everything is neutral.
Right. Kind of reminds me of like The Lobster.
Yeah. Totally.
There's drama in the mundane.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Or like insane things are happening, but they're reacting to them like in very small ways.
Yeah. Which is not quite greener grass, but there's definitely an aspect of that.
Yeah.
But photographers we used as
well. Yeah, I love that as a nugget of advice, right? Because I think that so often you start getting into movies because you love movies. And so you kind of keep pulling from those reference points. And then things end up you just end up with like watered down Tarantino or something.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like that's an easy pitfall for young filmmakers to make.
And I think, I mean, something we think about all the time is like, how do you make a movie that gets into Sundance, right? Like that's the big question. And if you see, I haven't seen your feature, but I've seen your shorts. Like you can see how it's like a voice and like an angle that you haven't really seen much before, you know?
That's nice.
It's probably because of that, right? Because you're not saying like, oh, it's like Pulp Fiction, but with moms, right? It's like,
yeah, I wonder. I will say to our fellow filmmaker listeners that we tried to get into Sundance 3 times before we got in with our feature, and in those rejections, had the opportunity to kind of build a relationship with the festival, which
good.
I think is interesting. We submitted Greener Grass, and we got this very nice letter from one of the programmers who was like, "This was one of my favorite shorts. It came really close, but it didn't get in, and we didn't have a place for it." And then the same thing happened with Buzz and The Arrival. Oh, four things.
And then we were rejected again,
yes.
A fourth time, when we applied for the labs. Mm-hmm. We were finalists.
Which, by the way, is
with Greener Grass?
With this script that may never see the light of day, a feature that did have a baby. but that is the reason we made The Arrival, is because we wanted to do the screenwriter's lab and then do the directing lab.
Right, right.
But we didn't have a short that we had directed, because Mitch McGee directed Buzz, our friend, and we love Mitch McGee.
I joke, but I think it might be true. I might be the biggest Mitch McGee fan.
You are not, because I am.
Yeah, no, I am.
I fucking love
it. Yeah, so we hadn't directed anything.
Gotcha.
So we scrambled to do The Arrival. We did it in like a month and a half, I think, from writing the script to submitting it to some... Or no, we just had to finish it so we could say we had directed something.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Because when you were applying for the directing lab, you had to have directed something
mm-hmm,
before.
Mm-hmm.
And were you always a team?
Our first project together was Greener Grass, the short, in mm-hmm. 2015.
And you wrote and acted in it. Mm-hmm. You wrote it for yourself because you were frustrated with waiting for people to give you parts that were good?
Kind of, we just wanted to make something.
Yeah.
I think. I wouldn't call Jill and Lisa like parts that are good.
I mean,
not in the short.
They're not very juicy roles for any actor.
No, it was more, I mean, like, yeah. We love playing Jill and Lisa, but it was kind of our fantasy as like writers and world builders to make Greener Grass.
I guess I'm going to rewind now. So you were both actors before you were writers?
Yeah. So Don and I know each other because we were put on a mod team, which is the sketch teams mm-hmm. at the Upright Citizens Brigade in New York. Mm-hmm. So we were on this team called Onassis, which might be the best mod team ever to exist in the Upright Citizens Brigade program.
Yeah, it definitely is.
Yeah, I think that's right. I wasn't sure, Don, but I'm glad you confirmed
it.
Yeah,
I've looked it up.
I just Googled it. Yeah, it's in the top 100.
That's right. Onassis.
Way
yeah.
better than Bombardier.
Wait, don't rag on my
LA team.
That
was Jocelyn's other sketch
team. Anyway,
there are a lot of great people from Onassis, though, right? Like that.
Paul Briganti, Josh Rubin,
right.
Emily Altman, Cassia Miller, both like mm-hmm. Emmy-nominated TV writers.
Yeah. Lauren Adams from Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt.
Then Frank Hale, who's an incredible actor, comedian. Mm-hmm. Jason Sines, incredible stand-up. Rob Michael Hugel. Just such a great actor. Who am I forgetting?
Alex Cordellis.
TV writer. Corey Walter Johnson.
That's a great big team, you guys. Yeah.
But anyway, Onassis was like our family in New York. I moved to LA first, and then Don followed kind of at the end of the year. And we were the only Onassis people that lived in LA at the time. And then we were like, well, we're just going to hang out with each other. And we truly went to the gym together, which neither of us are gym rats in any way, but we had nothing else to do.
Yeah, we would like eat avocado toast for an hour and go to the gym. And it would somehow take from like 9 a.m. to 1. And I think after a couple of months of that, we were like, maybe we should use this time to actually do something productive.
But at least you were making money, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yes.
Just because this is something that comes up on our podcast a lot, and we get a lot of emails about this, like, I guess we always talk about New York as being like not a bad place for film and acting and all that stuff. Like, what made you move to LA, and like, what, like, do you think it was the right move? I mean, obviously, you just had a movie at Sundance, so it seems like things are going well.
For that alone, it makes me so grateful that I moved to LA. The fact that I feel like in New York, what was happening with me, at least, is I was booking consistent enough work mm-hmm. as an actor that I was like paying my rent and
like TV and film stuff,
mostly commercials and lots of College Humor back when College Humor was doing better produced stuff. No. Not that they're not now. Like outside, using outside people. And I always knew in the back of my head that I wanted to write and direct, but it was just like that I was just so busy with improv and sketch and my work that I just wasn't doing it at all. And
did you go to film school or anything?
No, I was an acting major in college, doing a lot of like Shakespeare and Chekhov and kind of stuff at the University of Illinois out in the cornfields. And
Don, were you focused more on acting or writing?
I had a bunch of random careers in New York that oddly prepared me exactly for what I'm doing now in a way I didn't imagine.
You're an orthodontist.
I was an orthodontist. No, I worked for a photo dealer of like a fine art photo dealer for several years. So we would just, it was this like very eccentric older English woman. And she truly taught me all about photography and composition. And we'd go to photo auctions and museums and stare at photos and talk about them for hours on end. And then I also...
What a weird, perfect job to have.
It is so weird, but Dawn is invaluable behind the monitor.
That's incredible.
Like her eye for composition is so fantastic.
Huh. You're like, we could sell this frame for $8,000.
And then, I also was an actor. I did did off broad, mostly stage stuff. I was in an off Broadway show for 6 years and did a lot of UCB. And then I had another random career for a while for a Swiss finance firm.
Cool. I mean, if you're going to work in finance,
that also helps with our LLC.
It does, kind of.
Is that where you funneled the money to finance your shorts?
Yes, exactly. No. So anyway, but I basically decided to move to LA kind of after visiting Jocelyn out here.
I was lonely and proselytic.
You're like, the gyms are amazing.
Yeah.
The toast.
Yeah.
Toast. You got, so Don, you're going to love this toast. I mean, they don't really have decent avocados in New York. That is true.
That is true.
That's the main reason I moved.
Yeah. It's a pretty good one.
No, and I remember it was also kind of in the back of my head that one day I would move to LA. Mm-hmm. I think I had kind of hit basically what I thought was like, where I would go in my career in New York.
Onassis got retired at the theater too. So we were all in a bit of a like, what do we do now?
Yeah, and I remember I was visiting Jocelyn in LA and she basically said, no matter what, you kind of have to start over when you get to LA. Yeah. You have to re-meet casting directors. You have to, you know, learn how to drive.
So did you know how to drive?
I hadn't driven since I was 18,
yeah.
So it was like 15 years or something without driving, and I avoided the 101 the first year I lived here, and it took so long to get places.
Wait, you like didn't want to drive on the freeway?
Don also didn't make left turns.
No, Jocelyn was like, I'll drive.
But yeah, this, I feel like the point that Don was making, I was such a shock to me when I first moved to LA because I had been with CAA for several years. I had a manager.
Right.
I had just had a leading role in a film that was at Sundance and being distributed by IFC Films. And I was like, oh, I'm in a great position.
Yeah.
I have like
this was all in New York. Fine, everyone.
Yeah,
don't
this
worry.
Is all out of New York. And then when I got to LA, I still had those managers and like that fancy agency. And I got several auditions, but my life changed completely because I no longer had my community of people asking me to do little shoots every other week. And the commercial world is so different out here. Like in New York, you can really be a big fish in a small pond when you're a weekly performer at the UCB, or at least when I was living there, that was the case. And in LA, there are people who are career commercial people who, you know, have Christmas dinner with the casting directors and what blah, blah, blah. It's just like a totally different thing. So that's why I was telling my friends, like, I think Don was like, well, I'm kind of waiting to get a good agent. And I was like, I have the best agent. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, you have to come out here.
Well, yeah, it is crazy because, like, on one hand, like, we tell people if you come to LA, like, you literally, any coffee shop you walk into, like, five people will be like, you'll see Final Draft on their computers, right? Yeah. Like, you'll, even if you don't try to be surrounded by people that are doing, like, the same thing that you're doing, you'll fail, right? Because everyone is just doing it, and it's part of the job is to like be surrounded by it, right? Mm-hmm. To be inspired and reminded, and like to compete with the people next to you. But on the other side, it's like you are like the best actress in Cleveland, and you come here, and like no one wants to talk to you, right? Because there's just every best actress from Cleveland already came here. Mm-hmm. So it's hard, I guess. Sure.
But I think your point, though, Jocelyn, about like just kind of getting in. The sooner you tear that Band-Aid off, the better, because you do start from scratch again, right? Like you are, you just have to jump in and get that whole process going so that you get to that success a little bit sooner.
And not to say you can't have great success in New York and just stay in New York, but if that's what you want to do and you want to be in LA.
But you think you couldn't have done like these shorts and the movie in New York?
I think we could have. I just think we didn't have that open time that it was birthed out of.
Yeah. I feel like in New York, I was always felt extremely busy, but I don't know what I was doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, New York is a way more social city than LA, right? Like everyone is having dinner like from 8 p.m. to 1 a.m. like every night of the week at restaurants, and people don't like hang out at home that much, I feel like.
Yeah. Totally.
Compared to here, where it's like you have so much free time, and even when you're in your car, you're by yourself thinking about things, right? Yeah. Like in a way that you're not in New York.
Yeah. Don and I both are middle children, and we don't like to be alone. So it works really well because we spend all day together, and then when we're in traffic, call each other to talk. And it's, LA is isolating. So I was like, oh, I found someone who's just as lonely as I am.
Perfect.
Truly.
And so did you guys do anything to make money when you were here? I guess you were still doing commercial acting.
Yeah, but I was doing a lot of improv coaching and also babysitting when Don and I first started working together.
I, 2 weeks before I moved to LA, had signed a book deal. I did this book of, like, comedic essays and preteen diary entries.
What's the book called?
Well, I'm so glad you asked. It's called My 1992 Diary.
Wait, how did you get that? Did you have like a book agent or something?
It was random. I was not a writer.
Random house.
Not a random
house. It was Penguin.
Yeah. My mom was cleaning out our basement and came across all my diaries from when I was a preteen and like sent them to me. And my husband and I were reading them and like laughing, and he's like, "Oh, this was when Tumblr was really a big thing."
Yeah.
I don't know if it still is, but he's like, "Just put them up on a Tumblr. These are really fun." And so I did, and somehow it like my blog got picked up by it was on the front page of like Yahoo, and then it was on like CNN and all of these serious news sources. And like so basically
the preteen became, discovered.
A woman from the 90s. And somehow it became like a bit of a viral thing.
Right. That's kind of like the sweet spot of like, you have a successful Tumblr that then becomes
a book deal. Yeah. And then I guess I'm writing a book now. So I really lucked into that. But the timing was such that I got this advance and I was like, oh, I could quit my dumb, weird Swiss finance job that I've been trying to quit forever. And maybe I'll use this time to move to LA.
Wait, did you bring your husband with you?
I did.
That's like, I feel like a lot of people we hear that have trouble moving to LA, it's because of that.
Well, my husband actually, he lives and works in Seattle, and we've always been in a long distance relationship.
Oh, wow.
And so when I was in New York, I'm like, maybe I'll move to LA. He's like, yes, we'll be on the same coast.
Yeah.
One day we'll live in the same state.
Yeah. Wow. So he still lives in Seattle?
He splits his time between Seattle and here.
Oh, wow.
And Don goes there too.
I go there, yeah.
Seattle's a really great town too.
It's great.
Yeah. You should try the coffee. I hear.
It's the best.
I hear things. Yes. Well, cool. So, okay, so you made this short, and did you do UCB stuff in LA too?
I do a weekend team called Search History, where we go through people's Google search history and then do an hour of improv based off that. Mm-hmm. And I was put on that team, I think, about 6 months after I moved. But before that, I did audition for Harold Knight under Alex Berg. And I had already been on Harold Knight in New York mm-hmm. for like 2 years on what I think was the best Harold team at the time. And then I didn't get a call back for Harold Knight. Yeah. And then like 6 months later was put on a weekend team and I was like, okay. Darcy Carden also auditioned at the same time. And I don't remember if she got a call back or not, but we both didn't get on.
Yeah.
And then now we're on a weekend team together.
There's a little bit of like LA and New York rivalry with that.
Yeah. So I just wanted to throw that out there for people that it still isn't easy at UCB either.
And you see people going into those auditions and they know all the judges or is that what you call a person that's judging? A judge?
But then Don and I both did Mod Night out here too. I actually was on a team that lasted 4 years called Bombardier.
Mm-hmm. And I was on a team called The Bus, which lasted 1 year. R.I.P.
But Don, I've always been an actor on Mod, but Don was always an actor in New York and then was on The Bus as a writer.
Yeah, that's interesting how they split it up like that.
Yeah.
So were you not writing for Bombardier?
Never. No, they didn't let me.
Fast forward, you guys are making your shorts, right? So that brings us up to like Greener Grass is doing really well. It's going to France and Austin and all these great places. What makes you say, hey, let's turn this into a feature film?
Yeah, or like, and also what's... Like, how do you get it financed and all that stuff? I guess that's a big question.
Greener Grass, as we've described, kind of took on a life of its own. IFC approached our managers interested in seeing if we wanted to pitch a series. And then we did. Mm-hmm. And we sold it to IFC. Mm-hmm. So we didn't actually pitch that around.
And was that your first TV pitch thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, I had pitched a TV version of That Couple You Know, which is this little show I did with Mike Scollins and Josh Rubin and Emily Altman, where Josh Rubin and I play an annoying couple, basically. So I had been through the TV pitching process with that. But then it was our first time pitching together.
Yeah.
Can you give us the logline for Greener Grass?
The TV show, yeah.
Oh my gosh, I can't even remember it.
I know.
Is the short different from the feature? And like it's the same characters, but right?
And just to clarify, you're pitching a TV version.
Which was quite different from the short in a way that we then kind of stripped when we were doing the feature and went back to the roots of the short.
I see.
Yeah.
And the short's about two competitive women, right?
I feel like at one time our log line was like, well, Jill and Lisa compete, or no, well, their children compete on the soccer field, Jill and Lisa compete on the bleachers. But then we moved away from that.
Yeah, but because it's hard to like put tone into a log line.
It is hard.
So much of what.
But it's like, I mean, you're competing, but it's like so extreme, like if one of you doesn't have a baby, then the other one will give their baby away to be cooler, right?
Yes, and we try not to give away plot points that aren't in the short, but that one is in the short, and it does happen in the future. So we were at IFC we were developing that pilot for, I want to say, like 5 or 6 months.
So how does that work? Is there a production company, or they just... Like your manager, IFC comes to you and they're like, hey, we love your short. Pitch this to us as a TV show.
It was that kind of thing. Yeah. And then we went with Brillstein, who were our managers at the time. And
did they help you develop the show at all, or was it just the two of you?
It was the two of us. And then we did go into their conference room and pitch it. And they gave us some great notes. And
Can I just to dig in a little deeper into that? How do you structure a pitch for a TV show? Like for that TV show?
Yeah, what we did is we made a pitch packet that I think was, how many pages was that? Like,
I want to say around 15.
Yeah, and so Josh Rubin is the one who put together the pitch packet for That Couple You Know, which was then what we modeled Greener Grass.
Right. You're like, oh, I've got one of these.
Yeah, exactly. So that it's like these very beautiful pages that were done by a graphic designer that we paid.
And Josh also has a background in commercials. So like there's like a magazine style.
Very beautiful pitch decks.
And
so with that designer, do they help you find the images and stuff too?
We actually made a Google Doc with all of the images. And so we were like, page three, tone, and then like six Google images, and then a paragraph. And then the graphic designer laid it out, and she made it all look like an old-timey newspaper kind of thing. Yeah.
That's cool.
And
so you printed it out for your pitch?
Yeah, we gave it to them. Now I'm remembering we were told to give it to them after the pitch, so they're not flipping through it the whole time.
I 1,000% agree with that. Like, that's a thing.
Well, we've had a lot of debates because I pitched this show a couple of years ago where we had like a presentation, like a PowerPoint type of thing. First, it was like images and text, and then we were like, no, no, that doesn't work. And then it was just images, and we were talking about them. Because we felt like it would help us set the tone. And like when we talk about a character, like you could see so much if we just put a picture of someone, you know, their race and their age and all that stuff, that you don't have to like just unload details like that during the pitch.
I remember debating about this too. And then actually, I think what we ended up doing was giving the pitch packet to them.
Yeah.
But like I said, we didn't take it around.
And then they start just, well, I mean, look.
Well, they bought it.
They bought it, so, you know.
So what do they buy a pilot, or how what happens
they
then?
They buy a pilot, but you also negotiate your contract for 6 years, which you can then renegotiate after 2 years, I think. But that's very interesting.
As showrunners, or as producers, creators, writers.
I think we were co-EPs.
That could become EPs, I think, the second year, or something like that.
Yeah. It was negotiated that we would star in it, but not necessarily direct.
Yeah, and that was one part we were very worried about because we really wanted to direct it.
What, can I ask you why it was so important for you to direct it?
I want to say first and foremost that Paul Briganti and Mitch McGee, who did our first two shorts, were our film school. Like, they let us shadow them. Our editors let us sit there and, like, learn about shots. And sitting in on the edit taught us so much about writing and also writing for film and also directing. So those were absolutely invaluable. But then when it got to a certain point that we were like, oh, we know how to make a shot list or, like, we found that because we're writing it and we happen to write kind of unusual worlds that just no one gets the tone as well as we do in our brains, of course. And we just felt like we wanted to be the ones making the decisions and felt confident to do that.
I think, too, with doing our three shorts and sitting in on the edit every single moment, we really, with our scripts, write with the edit in mind so much. And we see exactly...
In a way that you didn't before.
Not at all.
Yeah. And we really think about what you see in the frame when in every moment.
Yeah.
That I think it's gotten to a point where it would be so hard to write something and not direct it.
Right.
We would have to do so much more stage, like, description in order to get what we wanted.
This is a 300-page script. I think it's going to run about 72 minutes.
Wait, and you guys are always on the same page? I mean, the tone is so unique and the visuals are so original that it's, like, hard to believe that it's coming out of two people, you know, and not one.
Yeah. I feel like we certainly will go back and forth about the way that something will be, but I feel like that happens the most in the development process. So like, oh, should she have a son or a daughter? I don't know, this and that, blah, 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 going back and forth, and then come up with an answer to that, that by the time we're on set, we're like on the same page. But yeah, I feel like developing together is the only way we get to what we get, because it's always like, I'll pitch a little something and then Don will make it better and then we'll take that and I'll have an idea, and it's so much collaboration.
Well, what about on set? Is one of you more worrying about the camera and one more worrying about performances?
How did the responsibilities get sliced up?
Everybody always asks us that, and the best answer we can think of is like, we always tell people that we're like a two-headed monster, like, mm-hmm. or no, we have the same brain, I should say, a one-headed,
two-headed monster.
No, but we're like, think of us as one person,
right?
And we both do
everything, which sounds like it would be chaos, but it somehow isn't. And I think it's because as much as possible, we do everything that we can in the preparation. Mm-hmm. So when we're shot listing, we really, really are on the same page then. Like if we have disagreements, mm-hmm. it's ideally happens then and we figure it out before we get to set.
Right.
And then we just know exactly what we want to do. And it's not like we're both talking to an actor and telling them different things or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, like in any given scene, often one of us will be communicating with the actors and right. we'll try and be mindful that we aren't both bombarding an actor, for example. Mm-hmm. But
not that it's never happened.
Yeah. Right. Have you been on sets with two directors? I mean, I've co-directed a couple things, but I've also been on other sets where there's two directors.
I did do one co-directed thing that, now that I think of it, is funny because, it was like a reality style thing where they basically should have just hired me to write is what I think they wanted to do, but just didn't know better, I think.
Yeah.
It was a show called Ghost Hunt, and it was like reality style where people who had ghosted each other got brought back together.
So anyway. You co-directed that?
Yeah, I co-directed that.
Yeah, I've seen like with other directors, it depends. Some of them are
and
like
it was a nightmare, I should
so
say.
In tune with each other. Like Mitch and Phil, these two sure. guys, one of them, Phil is like kind of more the artsy person and Mitch is more the technical person. They're both, Phil is very technical and Mitch is very artsy and creative, but like on set, like Phil they is work. More like messing with the art department and Mitch is more like messing mm-hmm. with where the camera's going. And he tends to talk to the actors a little bit more. But also when things aren't going well is like when you notice it the most, because there's just all these whispers behind the monitor. Right. And it can be, I think for the actors, like unsettling yeah. sometimes, like, did you like that? Did you not like that?
Yeah.
Is it like,
so, what are they talking about? You know?
Yeah. And in commercials, it happens all the time, right? Because right. the agency, and there's 400 people totally. Giving notes after yeah. every take.
And then you like, walk over and you're like, sorry. And you rotate a pillow.
Yeah, yeah. exactly.
That's well, that's like my dream is to be like, sorry, it's just this pillow looks weird. But the worst is when they're like, can you just say it? Like, can you just smile more, you know, when you're saying it? I know it's a funeral scene, but like they just want a positive spin on it.
Just one way you smile, please.
Yeah. Well, that's cool that you feel like it's not even something that comes up.
Yeah. It's, and we had the luxury too of, I always feel like being directors now after being actors for years, mm-hmm. we've gotten to be on so many sets and see how different
right.
ships run. Different captains run their ships. And I have definitely worked with directing teams a lot, particularly Josh and Vin, mm-hmm. but other ones too. And I think, so I had that in mind very much of like, we need to yes and each other mm-hmm. it, always in front of people and oh, anything else, you know. But also I will say Don and I are both Midwestern middle children and very uncomfortable like with
conflict.
We're, yeah, not that we can't handle it. We certainly can, but it's not our mode to, sure.
to
yell.
Challenge each other.
Like, yeah, I don't think I heard my parents fight until I was like in my 20s. So like, just it's like definitely a mode yeah. of like, well, we're gonna keep the everything good. Everything's yeah, gonna yeah. be fine.
We're gonna do one take like this, yes. and then we got that just for something totally different. Let's try it this way, and then we
Let's
both get.
Yes, we can get an alt of that, Dom. Yeah. That'll be an alt we'll get. No, I'm kidding. I'm making us sound like nightmares.
That is the way to do it, though, right?
You
know,
I think so.
It's easier to just shoot it two ways, and then you know you'll come to your senses later.
Just shoot it.
Yeah,
just
there you go.
Yeah.
I think also because with at least like Greener Grass in our shorts, because we wrote them and had read them out loud to each other a million times, mm-hmm. we really are so on the same page with how we imagine the performances.
Yeah.
But. Yeah. What I'm hearing is just that it's all on the prep, right? Like just
so much. And you
over avocado toast, you get it done, you know?
Of course, everything changes on the day,
sure,
as everyone knows. But when you have that prep together, you can at least be like, well, this is what we're going for. Mm-hmm. So let's
make
a decision.
That's your baseline to start from.
Do you guys give each other like performance notes? Like, oh, you know, it would be funny if you like grab this candle away from me before
Totally. I'm sure that's the most creepy thing about watching us is watching us give each other notes.
Yeah, that's
it's like
be real weird.
Strange pillow talk that everyone gets to witness. But we do have such a shorthand with each other that we're able to like give each other like quick intense notes and performances change, and I'm sure it looks very strange to outside people.
I'm curious about just the mechanics of you two both being in front of the camera for what I assume is the majority of the movie, right? Mm-hmm. So like how like is an AD calling action for you and all of, like how does that work? Is there anything weird or unique in that way?
Playback is so valuable. Mm-hmm. So what we do is we usually block the scene and then we roll on the rehearsal. Mm-hmm. So then we can give any notes with like, oh, that picture frame is reflecting this light or whatever like that. And then we'll usually roll another one and then we feel like everything is set. Then we'll start doing takes. And then we usually have a feeling of we've got it, which comes usually internally, like, oh, I think that was good. We've got it. And then we'll watch playback on that and then usually do another one. And then in the edit, use the one that we thought when we got.
The second to last take is kind of the winner.
It really is. Yeah.
And you don't have trouble like getting into character and stuff like when you're also worried about I mean, I guess all actors have to like hit marks and do weird timing and stuff for the camera.
I think that's a part of film acting that is so different than stage acting. Mm-hmm. Is there's always one part of your brain that's being technical. And we do have our AD call action and cut usually if one of us isn't in the scene sometimes. But I feel like the AD just called action and cut on our set.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think if I struggled as an actor, like in an honest way. Mm-hmm. There are times when it is hard because you're worried about so many different things.
Right. Especially if you're like running late or something and you know you have to cut like 5 shots and now you're trying to figure out how to do the scene in less shots, but you're also a character that's just supposed to like take their time right in the living room.
Yeah.
It was harder for me than I thought it would be to act and direct like on our feature. And I think there was also just a lot of elements at play. We were moving quite fast. Mm-hmm. And
what sort of page count were you guys doing?
We were doing probably 7 or 8 page days.
Yeah.
And we had several scenes that were outdoors in 95 degree sun and just
thunderstorms looming in a movie that doesn't have weather.
Yeah. Where did you film it?
Georgia in August.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It was a 19 day shoot. We had 17 location moves.
Yeah, there were babies and dogs. Mm-hmm. And so I guess it might not be as a result of like acting and directing was much as just
making
a
feature
of stressful circumstances that we put on ourselves.
Right. So you did the pilot for IFC and then it didn't go.
We were just in kind of an unfortunate situation of we were on a slate of I think 13 pilots that got wiped when there was
a regime change.
But it was the best thing that happened to us, honestly, because it's why we directed the feature.
So you had the pilot script and but then you abandoned that, right, and started writing the feature at that point.
There was about a week period where we were like, we should repitch this to other networks. We never really went around with it. And during that week, Jocelyn was down in Austin shooting the indie feature Thunder Road.
I was acting in that.
Jim Cummings.
And I happened to be at a film festival at the Napa Valley Film Festival because The Arrival was showing there.
That's the best one, right?
The most delicious wine and food.
We won an award at that festival, and the award is like a 3.5 foot tall bottle of wine.
We still have not drank it.
Yeah, we're like, when
a Magnum?
Throw a party then.
But I think, oddly, both of us being apart from each other and having those experiences of Jocelyn being on an indie set making a movie with a lot of friends, and I was
and as DIY not DIY but like there's a spirit to what Jim's trying to do. Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And yeah. I was surrounded by all these other director, like filmmakers that week and talking about,
right.
you know, your next project.
Sure.
And we both right. kind of got back to LA and we were like, what if we didn't pitch this as a TV show? What if we just made a movie? Mm-hmm. And from that point, it was like just a quick, fast decision, and we were off and running with.
Yeah.
Did you guys like high five each other at the end of this conversation?
Yeah.
And so, how long did it take you to write the feature?
I would say we started really writing it in January, mm-hmm. and then we sent
of last year.
Yeah.
Of 2018.
Yeah. Yeah. We sent our producer Natalie Metzger, who is a producing god walking among us.
How did you attach her?
So she had done our short, The Arrival, mm-hmm. and we found her from Jim Cummings, mm-hmm. who our short, Greener Grass, was in competition with Thunder Road at South By.
Gotcha.
And so we kind of met at a party and then Facebook messaged him and we were like, you had the best short at South By. Who is your producer?
Right.
We want a producer. And that's how we found Natalie. And
when you attach a producer to a short, do you like have to pay them or how does that work?
So Natalie kind of decided what she would be paid and we always see it as a line item, but it's never a conversation for some reason. Like, this is what I need to make. But we're like, oh, that's how much Natalie's giving herself. That's sure. not enough.
Right, right. Yes.
But so you raised money for it and then you give her the budget. You're like, we have
this
20
amount
grand
of money.
Or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. And for our feature, we were very lucky in that we had a sole investor who was like a fan of the short film who wanted to fund the feature, which is insane and rare.
Was there like a certain, did you know how much money you needed?
We went to Natalie with the budget, which was what this investor had said.
Oh, like, here's the lump sum, basically?
Yeah, was willing to fund. And we're like, this is the script.
Wait,
is the amount of money we have. Can we do it?
Yeah. Right.
So you met this investor and you were like, what's the most amount of money you can give us?
No. They were basically like, I want to give you this
like,
amount
here's what
to
I got.
Make a
yeah,
feature.
Yeah, yeah.
And
it's not a film person.
No.
Just a fan of...
We joke like an orthodontist frustrated with the popularity of Invisalign.
Sure, yeah.
A movie about braces. Yes.
Right. Finally.
He's funded some other film projects, but...
For other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not his... He's not in film.
But that's a really fast track then.
Yeah, you started writing in January and then you were in Sundance in January? That's like insane.
Yeah,
that is.
It was.
I thought making a movie takes 2 years.
That's why, Matt, you were like, I haven't seen you in 3 years. And I was like, really? I have, like, we have just been off the planet.
Yeah. Making a movie. Great. Good. Yeah.
We met with Natalie in, I think, May with the script. And we were down in Georgia in pre-pro in July.
Wait, and
we shot in August.
I just got a head rush from that sentence.
Wait,
that
is insane. But when you wrote the script, I guess you had written features before, right?
We had written one that got rejected from the Sundance Labs.
Right. So did you know this was good?
Like,
did you get a lot of notes? Like, I guess, what's the process? You were just like, this needs to be a movie and let's make it.
We thought it was good. We did have a couple round tables with our Onassis friends and some other people, which were very helpful, but also the tone of our movie is so unique mm-hmm. that everything obviously needs to be calibrated to us and our sense of humor. And even our funniest friends were pitching jokes and changes that we were like, this is so funny. We know this is so funny. And then got back and we're like, it's not right.
Yeah.
And so we found that while getting notes is very valuable, it really, we worked fastest and best when we did it.
Sure. It's funny. So I was just talking to my wife about this because we will, like, once we have a script ready, we'll like do like a table read with mm-hmm. we'll bring over a bunch of friends and kind of like go around. And, you know, I have a phrase, I can't remember where I first heard it, but like of people who know enough to do real damage. You know, like they're really smart, they're very funny, but like don't necessarily get what you're trying to do or whatever, or it's not your taste or their taste or whatever. And how I'm not sure that like the pizza party table read is maybe actually helpful.
That's so funny we're talking about this, because Don and I do talk about that, and I think that is true. I think it can be very helpful.
It can be, and it's not to say don't be open to notes or criticism or the way that people are perceiving your movie, but like sometimes you've just got a blowhard friend or something, and it's like they don't get it, and it's hard to just you can't just shut them up, right? Like that's rude. They're there to give you notes, you know.
And probably it depends. Like if you read like The Social Network, right? Like an Aaron Sorkin script, and the dialogue is just like amazing, but it's not visual. You know, obviously sure. The movie ended up being visually.
It's a radio play, yeah.
But it also is like a script that's meant to be read. It's different than if you read The Lobster or something, right? And people are like, this, like, why is he turning into a lobster? You know,
that is such a good point. And our short film Buzz, which everyone needs to watch. It's not up, but we had an interesting thing of Don and I thought it was for sure a comedy, but very little in the script signified that, but we so knew that it was, and it's at festivals it hits great as a comedy, but
our producer did not think it was a comedy. While we were shooting, he thought it was a very serious short film,
and even Mitch McGee would sit here and talk with us about it, and the three of us were butting heads a little in a very constructive way. But about whether or not it was a comedy. And Don and I were like 100% sure it was. So it's just a funny thing. And then it is. So tone is like...
It's hard, really
tricky.
Yeah.
I almost feel like that's a sign of a good movie, is if like the table read goes bad, it means that it's different enough that people are not used to it, you know?
Well, and I think sometimes people are just trying to tell you about the movie that they want to make.
I made this movie about like a deaf kid, and one of the people at one of our test screenings was like a special needs teacher, and she's like, I just don't think you even began touching on the special needs education opportunities that exist in America.
Right.
Like this, I don't care about that.
Yeah. They're wrestling.
That's your,
Like they get so fixated on this one thing. They think
or what they connected on, which isn't what the movie's about.
Yeah.
Well, cool. So you shot the movie, then you got into Sundance. You edited it for 1 month.
So really, we should say we shot the movie when we did, because we wanted to submit to Sundance. Mm-hmm. And I think part of that was...
And that's like everyone that doesn't get into Sundance says that's like the worst thing to ever do, right?
Sure. Is that true? I'm probably...
Well, I do think it's good to have that deadline, because it's kind of, I think, the earliest of all the deadlines. So it's nice to submit to Sundance, and then your movie's ready to send elsewhere.
Right. Exactly.
But everyone's like, a lot of people like race for this, like they edit their movie in like two weeks and they submit a work in progress and it doesn't get in. And then
they're like, oh, I wish we shot more days.
Or we edited longer, or we didn't blow all our budget, you know, in 2 weeks.
So Natalie, who produced our movie, also produced Thunder Road. Right. And as you guys probably know, Jim Cummings' short Thunder Road won an award at Sundance. It won the Grand Jury Prize for shorts. And his movie was just, I think it was 3 weeks short of being eligible for Sundance. Mm-hmm. And so he just didn't finish it in time or submit it in time. And so Natalie was very much like, we cannot do that. And we also were like, we gotta try. So I would say when we pencils down on our script, well, we never did. We knew we liked the script. We never were like, this is done. Mm-hmm. But we were like, we need to start casting. We need to start this. Mm-hmm. And we had major rewrites of the script while we were in Georgia. In the middle of shooting, we were rewriting scenes. Wow. So that is not ideal in any way. But I just know that I can't imagine ever feeling like the movie's ready, it's perfect, let's shoot. Right. We just did it, and I'm glad that we did.
You just had to. Yeah.
Yeah.
And why did you shoot in Georgia?
For the tax incentive. Our money seemed to go the farthest there.
Yeah, we got an extra 30% on top of our budget, basically.
Which is huge.
Yeah.
But you had to like fly out cast and crew and put everyone up and feed everyone and all that.
Yes, which is difficult.
But I guess for only like 3 weeks, right?
Yeah, and I would say too for our story, we really wanted it to seem like anywhere America and not have the palm trees. And
right.
Where we shot in Georgia, it just couldn't be more picturesque. And so that was part of it too. But yeah, flying people out. And we all stayed in a Holiday Inn.
Sounds great. Sounds like a blast. Genuinely. Was Sundance aware of your movie as you were making it? Like,
were they
tracking it, quote unquote?
Yeah, a little. That programmer who had written us the nice note happens to be a friend of Janixa Bravo's, who's an actor in our film who had Lemon at Sundance.
Gotcha.
And so they kind of knew each other, and Janixa was posting on Instagram, and that programmer was commenting, and then they had a phone call while we were on set. So we were like, good, we're on the radar.
Perfect, yeah.
Yeah, Janixa put in a good word for us with some programmers, and as did Jim Cummings. And
yes.
And Natalie, our producer, also had a relationship with Sundance, so they kind of were in communication with some of the programmers. Not a lot, but I think Sundance was aware. Yeah.
I think that's helpful for listeners, though, because, you know, you hear of like, oh, like who sent it, right? Who submitted it for you? All of that stuff. Or like, how are people even tracking, quote unquote, tracking a film in the first place? And like, it can be that simple. It can be, oh, my friend's a programmer. They saw me on Instagram, you know, like,
yeah.
And frankly, is maybe probably the best way of doing it rather than like pestering someone with something, you know, like,
yeah. And I thought it was interesting, Matt used the word tracking, that when one of the programmers was introducing our movie at Sundance, she was like, these are two girls that I've been tracking for years now. Mm-hmm. They've made these incredible shorts and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, they have been tracking us, even though we've kept feeling like, we were getting rejected by Sundance.
If you get rejected enough, they're at least aware of you.
Yeah.
That is a wonderful lesson, though.
It is, right? Because Natalie was gunning for Sundance, as were we, but we were always joking, we're never going to get into Sundance. Yeah. They don't like us.
But I do think, like, one version of the story that listeners hear is like, these two girls made their first movie and it got into Sundance. Right? And then the other version is like what we've just heard for the last hour, which is like, for years they worked together on a mod team in New York. They moved to LA and they restarted and they made short after short after short and got rejected and worked in other people's movies and did all this stuff and finally got into Sundance. You know, it's just like a new filmmaker, it's very hard for them to recreate what you did because you have like so many years of experience. You know, it's just kind of about the perseverance and like the long haul, it seems
We got to talk to a lot of like young filmmakers at Sundance. They put you in these like round tables where you can meet them.
It's and, like camp a little bit, right?
Yeah, and we found that one thing we kept saying is our careers did change when we actually made something, because that made all the difference for us to be able to have something to show people. And we have so many friends who are incredible writers who have scripts that they're shopping around. And not to say that's not a good way to do things, but for us, it helped to have something to kind of really show what our voice is. So we're like, if you can just shoot something that in our experience might take you farther than just shopping around a script.
Right.
And you're saying even like compared to acting, it just it's a different thing than making your own stuff.
It's a tricky thing. Like, I feel sensitive preaching that you have to make stuff as an actor, because I think acting is its own craft that is so, so special and so different from writing. Like, you do not have to be a good writer to be a good actor, nor do you have to be a director. It's its own art form that's beautiful and worthwhile. I think I wanted to direct and write separate from the fact that I'm an actor. So I don't want to tell all actors you have to make something, because I don't want that to be the case for them if they don't want to do that.
Yeah. Well, we've all seen the version of a semi-improvised, you know, drama, like The Big Chill, but millennial or something. You know what I mean? Like, and there's a good version of that out there, but like,
it's easy to kind of back yourself into trying something that maybe you don't have the ambition to hone that craft quite the same way.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. like being an actor is hard enough, you know, like that's a lifetime pursuit. So like,
yeah. But yeah. I do feel like, now I'm going to go back on what I'm saying, only to say, I do feel like when we're casting, like, for example, we directed 2 episodes of Adam Ruins Everything in the fall, and we really wanted to pitch all of our friends, and our friends that are terrific actors who don't have tape, we cannot pitch.
Right.
Like, right. in order to even get them seen by the casting director, you need to send the casting director something.
Yeah, so you can't just be like, trust me.
No.
Yeah, we were
and the directors are the ones saying, trust me.
Yeah.
Like, I want to cast this person.
We've seen this person on stage at UCB for years. Like, they're amazing. Please let them play this 2-line
sure.
part.
Yeah.
And...
Well, can you get auditions for them?
Well, we mostly did. I think we did almost all offers for our Adam episode, mm-hmm. just because we know so many actors. But I guess we could have had auditions, but
yeah.
they were just auditioning the kids for our episode, really.
Yeah, I think that show goes pretty fast, too. On
yeah, it is really fast. But it's something that I feel like when I was just an actor, I was really rolling my eyes at like websites and reels. And I was like, people know who I am. I don't need a reel or a website. But we really use those. Even for casting Greener Grass, we still had to pitch cast. I mean, we had the final say, but we still had to give our casting director something to
right.
to, you know, any blah, 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 blah. So actors have tape.
Can we talk a little bit about the future of Greener Grass, right? Like, you guys got a lot of great buzz. You know, it's like it seems like a pretty great year for Sundance. Like, people are finally buying things and all of that. What can you say about the future of the movie?
Well, one thing to say is we got back on Sunday and late Sunday night, Monday morning, we were back in the edit.
Mm-hmm.
So we are editing again.
Mm-hmm.
And
why?
Because mostly we had 6 screenings with the greatest test audiences.
Sure.
Yeah.
And we just want to fix things.
Yeah, yeah.
Mostly like carving out some jokes that we know are funny and we're like, why isn't this getting a laugh? Oh, there's a background child screaming right on the joke. Or
right.
Like
gotcha.
A lot of things like that.
Did you read like reviews and does that play into your editing at all?
We don't read any reviews.
Yeah.
A few friends or whatever have texted us quotes from the reviews, mm-hmm. so we're like a little bit aware.
Wait, you're not curious?
I think this is the thing. Our movie, I think we have known, had the potential to be something people loved or hated.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we fully
sure.
made this,
your
and we were
feels
like,
that way, right?
yeah, we're like half the theater might walk out,
right?
And we just knew that going into it. And so I think, I wish I could say, I don't care what the reviews are. Of course I want the reviews to be good, but I don't need to know what they say.
Mm-hmm.
Whether they're really good or really bad, that's not going to help me. Or like, I don't want it to influence the next thing we make.
That is our biggest concern, is we're trying to protect our next project.
So even if it was an amazing review and someone's like, you have a great review in LA Times or whatever, you would not read it?
I don't think we'll ever sit and read it on our phones, but like, Don's husband read a lot of our Variety review out loud to us, and that was really nice to hear, because it was really...
But we would be like, don't say
anything
like that's going
it,
to like... Yeah. mess with our heads.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was he reading it from Seattle?
No, he was at
Sundance.
Yeah. We're redoing a lot of things in the future to get it ready for South by Southwest.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so it's going to screen there already? Did they invite you?
They did. Yeah. We're part of like something like a festival favorites program.
Yeah.
So it's nice. Favorites from Sundance.
Yeah, basically. We're not in competition because we've already premiered, but
right.
Part of the program that of movies that was at Sundance.
Yeah. So are that's you going to South by?
We are, yeah.
Wow,
yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Sounds fun.
Yeah. But so we're kind of in this mad dash to get the DCP off to South by in time. So that is one thing that's next.
And you guys directed Adam Ruins Everything. Did you get that off the feature being at Sundance or off the shorts?
I suspect that we got that from Paul Briganti recommending us, who we got it while we were still down in Georgia, or we got the call about it. And then right when we got back, we met Adam and John and John at the Earth Cafe and talked about it. And then we got the job after that. So we were joking that like, oh, this is this magical period of time when we shot a feature, but nobody knows if it's good or bad.
Oh,
like we're totally riding on the...
Take your time.
Use it as leverage to get some other jobs.
Exactly.
You should never finish
it. It's okay.
Yeah. But it was, we had to join the DGA to do that. Like that's why we were laughing. It's like, oh, we're full blown directors now, even though our movie might be total...
Sure.
Crapola. I hope it's
I've read some reviews. It sounds like it's pretty good.
Oh, thanks, Matt.
No problem. Yeah. And so do you have anything else coming up? Do you have another feature? Are you going to do more TV stuff? What's the plan? Do the offers just, are they rolling in?
Yeah.
Are you doing a Marvel movie?
Rolling in.
It's only been a couple of days, but like have your lives changed in any way? You know, that's the real question, right? Like, did the fairy come down and like anoint you and now you're in the DGA and everything's perfect?
It is funny. Like, I do feel like when we got accepted into Sundance and that was public, it is this funny thing that we're trying to not take too seriously where all of a sudden, like, every agent and manager wants you. We're getting sent, like, scripts from production companies looking for a director. We're like, whoa, this is crazy.
Yeah.
But...
And that was all coming through your managers?
And some
directly.
People find us directly.
Yeah.
We have, like, an info address on our website. But yeah, so it does feel life-changing. Not that we think it's going to last forever or anything like that.
Yeah.
But I think we want to continue to make our own stuff. We, with a laugh, are like, we want to be the female Coen brothers. So we do want to keep making films that are, you know, really in our voice and their own unique worlds and stories. And so
we have like an idea for our next project, which when we were working with IFC, sort of while we were waiting for notes from them, we used that time to kind of develop our next project. And we have like an 80-page basically Bible for the world, but haven't touched it in about a year. So
that's perfect.
Truly, really, who knows what's in there.
Yeah.
Is your writing like regimented? Like, are you like, okay, tomorrow we're going to be working on developing or writing like from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m.?
Yes. And that has been life-changing to me, working with Don as a partner, because we are so productive, because we do treat our writing like a 9-to-5 job that's truly like 9-to-7 often. And
you guys are writing 9-to-7?
Well, we meet at each other's houses and
we have our toast.
We have coffee and toast.
Great, good.
And you know, we have lots of emails to answer and things like that. But when we're actually writing, can I talk about deep work?
Yes.
We do something that I feel like I heard about on NPR randomly that I was like,
Carlin is into this as well.
Oh, deep work?
Yeah.
I need to ask Carlin where I even got this idea. But basically, the crucial thing about it is that we set a timer, which is usually either an hour, an hour and a half, and then we turn off all internet and phones, and we can't look at any of that, and we deep work. And then at the end of deep work, we have either a 10 or 15-minute break, and then we go back into deep work.
And we get to have a snack.
Yeah, on the breaks we have snacks.
Yeah, that's
right. Wait, how long do you deep work for?
Usually either an hour and then you get a 10-minute break.
Yeah.
Or maybe a 5-minute break. And then an hour or an hour and a half.
And I'd say we try and do on like a work day, we'll do like 5 deep work sessions.
Mm. So yeah. 5 hours.
And then we have hours of not deep work.
Where we're like answering emails.
And so during deep work, are you ever like with a whiteboard writing scene ideas? Or are you just typing like in final draft or what?
We use Google Docs a lot for our, like instead of index cards or something, we outline in Google Docs. So we can both have it up on our screen. And then we write our scripts on Writer's Duet for the same reason, because we found that to be the easiest to have it up on both our screens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you'd think Final Draft would have fixed it by now. Like, the one thing you need is to be able to share a screen with somebody else.
It seems so simple, and I think they have something, but
they tried it's for never a while. Really worked. It's never worked. Yeah.
Wow, so during that hour, you're typing, you're writing. And then do you read your stuff to each other?
Oh, constantly.
Like, are you allowed to talk to each other during this hour?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We are always talking.
Okay.
And at any one time, only Jocelyn or I will be typing. So we'll both be brainstorming, talking out loud, and she'll type, or vice versa. Mm-hmm.
And do you pace a lot?
Pace?
Yeah.
No, we're always sitting.
Yeah.
What? Once in a while, we'll get up to act something out.
Yeah.
There's no exercise bike or anything.
We really should get one.
Yeah, we really should.
Wow, that's 5 hours. That's a lot.
Warren
of
and I are
work.
Both jealous.
Yeah, I'm like, that's how much I get in like a month.
Yeah, sure.
But I imagine now you probably are getting a lot of people saying like, "Hey, we have no one's figured out this novel. You know, like, can you read it and come pitch your take on it? Like, do you take a do you go
IP
for that?
This IP thing is so popular. Yeah. It's really funny. I think what we're going to do next is try to get a feature done before the next festival season, which means we need to shoot again in like July. So that is our rough plan, and that means we won't be doing adapted things.
Right.
But maybe we'll be tired and not do that.
And do you finance it again the same way, or however you figure
know.
It out? You
we're
figure
not
it out.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of depends on if your orthodontist is so stoked.
Yes.
That person makes
our next movie is very different. If we need to give everyone braces to get the money, we'll consider it.
Yeah.
Wow, that's awesome. Well, we should probably wrap things up.
Probably time to hop into unpaid endorsements.
Unpaid endorsements!
So, I've got 2 movie recommendations. One is a short of the week I saw on Twitter the other day. Have you guys seen Bickford Park?
No.
No.
It's really wonderful. It's by a husband and wife team out of Toronto. Bickford Park is like this kind of just a quiet black and white movie about a couple that are kind of, you know, on the rocks a little bit, and the woman is out for a jog and runs into a kid who's skateboarding, and she starts taking skateboarding lessons from him. And it's just kind of like,
I love that.
It's really like beautiful and quiet and funny and stylized in a way that's like awesome because it's just really controlled, you know? And it's 12 minutes. So Bickford Park is the number one. And then the other one is a documentary called Perfect Bid, which is about the guy who fed the answers to the contestant in The Price is Right who did a perfect bid down to the dollar for both showcase showdowns.
Wait, fed the answers like in an earpiece or something?
No, just shouting from like the audience.
What?
Because he's a
he got
super
away with that?
You're
Wait,
allowed
did they
to
know
do
each
it.
Other?
No, they didn't know. They met each other in line, but this guy is like a career Price is Right, career isn't fair. Like just a lifetime Price is Right fan who literally like programmed a game for himself where he would quiz himself on all of the different like prizes and how much they cost and just has an encyclopedic knowledge of Price is Right.
That's incredible.
That's amazing.
My grandmother won a stove on Price is
really?
Right.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
And this guy, like he was a diehard, but like is a little boring. And so it took him like 20 times before he got on the show.
Oh no.
Well, it depends like who else is there. Like if it's like a bunch of old people and they want to have like a couple young people, young-looking people, then I think you have a better chance of getting on.
Yeah, yeah. Just kind of the luck of the draw. So this guy, he was a math teacher, and he would spend his summer vacations coming down to go to Price is Right.
I have 2 really small ones. So I endorsed like an iPhone trick before, and everybody knew about it, but I have a new one that I feel like not as many people know.
I showed it to my wife last night, and she was like, what? And I was like, you should listen to the show more.
Yeah. Well, that one, it's kind of awesome, but I actually don't use it that much, even though a lot of people said it changed their lives. But this is my new trick. So from the lock screen, did you guys know this? If you swipe... You swipe left, you go straight to the camera, like without unlocking your phone, without face ID, without thumbs.
I did not know that.
So if you just pick up your phone, right, it's like off, and you just pick it up, and you swipe left, you get to the camera instantly, which is good if you have kids or dogs or just need to take a photo really quick, because usually it's taking me forever to like get to the camera. The other like iPhone trick is if you turn on the grid in your settings, you see the grid on the screen. If you take like an overhead shot, like you're doing like your food or whatever, it squirrel, then there's this
it's a toast
this
joke
crosshairs.
For non-Angelinos.
There's these crosshairs, and if you line them up, then you know your phone is perfectly level for those kind of perfectly level shots. So this other thing, I read an article about it. I'm still a little bit on the fence, but I think it's an interesting idea, is that like whenever you pour coffee for yourself, if you like cream in your coffee, that if you put the cream in before you put the coffee in, then you don't have to mix it.
We only do that.
Yeah, Jocelyn taught me that trick.
Huh. But I drink a lot of instant coffee. I'm sorry. Yeah. But
why are you drinking instant coffee?
Because we have this like instant hot water dispenser. So it's just so fast to make. I can make it in like 10 seconds.
That's cool.
And I have decent instant hot coffee.
No, you guys are being too nice.
But with that, you can't put the cream in first.
The thing that takes the longest with brewing coffee is waiting for your water to boil. So if you've got instantly hot water, you can still just throw it into a kettle.
I guess I could use like a French press. Yeah. No, but grinding
like
beans
over.
And putting,
Yeah, I make a pour over every single morning.
You do?
Yeah, it's my favorite thing.
Okay.
Warren, you got to do it.
Okay, you guys have to tell me if this is really common. But I feel like I've encountered a few dog owners that don't know about this. Mm. Rover.
Is it an app to get people to walk your dog?
To watch them.
Have seen my Justin Lerner, who lives across the hall from me, has a padlock on his door.
Oh, this is Wag, probably.
Oh, I'm thinking of the wrong
thing. I can't use Wag because I live in a loft that you like can't get in with one of those. But we travel a lot for work.
Sure.
And luckily, usually someone in my family can watch my dog. But when they can't, I use Rover, which is like a dating app for people to watch your dog. Like you can swipe through and find people.
It's literally like Tinder, but like, this person's going to watch my dog for
me.
Is it R-O-V-R?
R-O-V-E-R.
Oh, okay.
And you can get really great prices. Mm-hmm. Like usually the people I book on Rover are cheaper than my dog's daycare for like an overnight stay.
Yeah.
When do they come to your house?
You can do either.
Oh, wow.
You can have them come stay at your house. Like, one time I had a college student who was this sweet girl, just so excited to have a kitchen because she lived in a dorm.
Did you get to see, like, a picture? Like, this is a weird thing, but I feel like my wife would trust, like, a female stranger more than, like, a male stranger.
I bet there's some statistical proof that backs that up. I feel like, right?
Yeah.
Like, that makes sense.
I think that's true. That girl took Marceau, my dog, to the Grove every day.
Wow.
For like 6 days.
College students love the Grove.
Yeah. Rover.
Okay. Mine is a show.
Ooh.
It's a cabaret show in New York. So this is for the New York listeners or people that can get to New York. It's the Salty Brine Living Record Collection. And Salty is a cabaret performer who's been performing around New York, particularly the East Village, for the last decade.
Yeah.
He's hands down my favorite live performer I've ever seen. He's hilarious and like will make you laugh and cry. And what he does is he takes albums, kind of famous albums, and reimagines them, and like he'll sing them with like a jazz quartet, or he usually takes a different music genre and performs the album with like, and then he'll take he'll have like a theme. So this month he has a residency at Joe's Pub for this whole year, and he's doing Led Zeppelin. I think it's called Four. Mm-hmm. Is the album. I don't know anything about Led Zeppelin, but he's doing that album mixed with Tales of the High Sea and like excerpts from Treasure Island, the novel. So Salty Brine's living record collection. He's at Joe's Pub. He's doing shows basically throughout the rest of the year, every like 2 months. And go see him if you have the chance, if you're in New York.
I want to point out a fun fact about Salty Brine, which is that that is his given name.
No, yes. Really?
Yeah.
Salty Brine the Third. Wow. His grandfather is like a Rhode Island local celebrity.
Wait, is Brine his last name?
Yeah.
Brine, yeah. B-R-I-N-E.
And
yeah.
He has a state beach named after him. The Salty Brine's yes. State Beach.
His grandfather, who was like played a pirate on a local children's television show.
Well, cool. Thanks so much for talking to us and congratulations on everything. I mean, it sounds like a pretty good time to be you guys.
Well, yeah. Thank you. And we feel honored to be on this show. We are fans of you guys and so admire what you do for the filmmaking community.
Ah, shucks.
It's true.
Thanks, yeah. I mean, it's really... We just want to talk and record ourselves and hear ourselves.
Yeah.
We didn't realize other people had access to this for quite a while. So if we want to find out more about you or if our listeners want to see your shorts that are online and stuff, where should they go?
Vimeo.
Vimeo, yeah.
Vimeo.com, that's mm-hmm. your website?
Vimeo.com.
Yeah. we started
Vimeo.
Oh,
we do have a website.
Yeah.
It's called gulpsplash.com.
Yes.
We update it once every 2 years.
Yeah. Maybe update it sooner.
we should update
it. Or what should people type into Vimeo? Green or grass, and then they'll find your channel?
Yeah.
Yeah. And our like production company is Gulp Splash. So if you search that, I think that might be the name of our channel.
Yeah, that's
not positive.
It's one word.
That rings a bell, I feel like.
That's
actually two
words.
Which one? Who of you is Gulp and who's Splash? Gulping.
Oh, it's the dumbest name. And I blame Dom completely for this. It was like we never chose a company name. It was like we needed an LLC to transfer money in too quickly. And this was something Dawn and her husband were saying at breakfast in the morning just as a joke.
Yeah, so I'm like filling out the paperwork on like the California government website because I just had to make our short where like if someone gets injured, we need an LLC.
Right.
And so
it was that Dawn
just like spit it out, like gulp splashed. Okay, that'll be it. And then now it's just become our company name, which we don't like. And it's too late to change it.
It's too late to change it. But the reason it's called Gulp Splash, too, which is funny, is that Jeff used to cook scrambled eggs for breakfast, but it would take a time. You have to clean a pan. And then he started eating just hard boiled eggs. And he was like, they're so easy to eat. You just gulp splash. Breakfast is done.
Yum. Perfect.
And now it's our company.
I think it's kind of a cool name.
Yeah, it's not so bad.
Better than my first company, Suction Productions.
Suction Productions is
pretty
funny.
We liked Gulp Splash fine until Mitch McGee on the set of Buzz started using it like, oh, you guys, like we're in a rush. We just have to do it. So Gulp Splash.
And now we never can forget it.
Well, if you want to find out more about what we talked about, we're going to have a post on our website, justshootitpod.com. You can find us on all social media, at Just Shoot It Pod on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. On Instagram, I'm at O Kaplan.
And I'm at Mr. Matt Enloe. This episode was edited by Jay McAuliffe, produced by Madeline Rosewatt, and our webmaster is Ewan Williams. The music you're listening to right now is by the artist Jazar and provided by the Free Music Archive.
And if you can leave us an iTunes review, it would be very helpful. So do it.
Thanks, please. Everyone.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.